You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Biden says the U.S. will tap into the emergency oil supply to lower gas prices. We'll look at what's causing them to go up, how much Biden's move may or may not help, and what else it could take to bring them back down. Now, the holiday shopping weekend is on the way, but the retail market is still grappling with supply chain disruptions and inflation. Could mean fewer deals and fewer in-stock items for Black Friday shoppers. We're finding out what issues retailers are dealing with right now and how it could affect holiday gift giving. Marco Bastel is Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Supply Chain Management at Marquette University. Marco, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Rob, and thank you for inviting me.
There's been a lot of talk about supply chain concerns when it comes to whether that holiday gift, say, we want to buy is going to be on a shelf or a website or not. What kind of supply chain problems are you looking at that could tilt things one way or another?
Well, what's happening is we are dealing with what we would call an end-to-end decrease in the capacity to manufacture on one hand, but more importantly, to move and store the goods. So a lot of goods that we are shopping for now at this holiday time, right, is coming from Asia. And it's important, you know, to have the capacity actually to store them, to move them then into the hands of the end consumer. And workers are still getting ill. We don't have enough truck drivers. We have issues in ports. We have issues in rails. And all this is actually impacting the product availability.
I'm seeing some big retail chains saying, hey, don't worry, we got out early, we've managed to stock up on a lot of key holiday-type goods. Is this something that consumers are going to see and feel that much, do you think?
Yes. So what particularly big retailers did throughout the year, they started with something what we call stockpiling. So they put their orders in early. In the preparation for the holiday season and in the light of anticipation of the supply chain issues. So a result of that is that for sure we won't experience disruptions to such a great scale that we could if that wouldn't be done. But still, for certain products, we may experience delayed delivery times. Some shelves may be a little bit empty here and there. But overall, as a consumers, we will experience a little bit higher prices than if we compare this with the last year.
This is a global problem, as you mentioned, from manufacturing to delivery to the store shelf at all points in between. That said, do you think there are actions that a national government, say the United States government, could be taking, maybe even has taken, that can help get things flowing again?
Yeah, so the one that we all know about it is government actually helping the LA port to be open 24/7. That unfortunately will not help much, or at least it has not produced the same effect as we were hoping. The reason is that we have a lot of issues to move the product after the port. So, for example, here to move the product here in Midwest, in our hands, let's say here in Milwaukee area, you have to offload the container in the port. You have to put it on a train. You have to then store it somewhere in between. You have to put it on a truck, in a distribution center, in a van, and so on. And throughout this entire chain, we are experiencing what we call loss of capacity. Workers are still getting sick. We don't have enough truck drivers. Warehouses are full, as well as we are experiencing shortage of empty containers. And that all contributes to slowing down the flow.
There are concerns about inflation, some big numbers coming up when it comes to what people end up paying for products. How much of the inflation story do you see coming from the supply chain story that we're talking about?
It's an important contributing factor, right? And I think it's going to impact the inflation rate for as long as the issues persist in the supply chain. How much percentage-wise is difficult to say, but for sure I can say it's a contributing factor.
How much of this is going to be a short-term problem versus how much do you think this is revealing bigger systemic problems that we may be dealing with for, I don't know, years?
That's a very good question. I think short term, we'll just have to wait for pressure on supply chains to decrease, particularly after the new year when demand starts going down. So we'll be seeing issues lingering well into the second half of 2022. But long term, companies really have to ask themselves, is it the way we manage our supply chains and how we are designing them and what we are emphasizing, particularly in the last 3 to 4 decades, the key factor that companies were emphasizing was efficiency, right? And that's one of the reasons why we have such a long supply chains, inflexible supply chains that are also very susceptible to disruptions. And some of these will have to change in the future. We will have to rethink how we are managing supply chains, because suddenly this has become a board level discussions, a CEO level discussion. And I'm looking forward actually to see what how companies will react after that short-term issues actually fade away.
That's something I've been wondering about, because I've seen people mm-hmm. point toward just-in-time production models mm-hmm. Getting disrupted by this. Mm-hmm. Do you expect those boards to actually make these changes, or is this going to be a case where, oh, things go back to normal a year from now and we're just going to go back to the old way of doing things because when things work well, it's cheaper?
Yeah. Great question. You know, we have to see. This is exactly what happened, for example, with disruptions related to 2011 earthquake in Japan. Automotive industry, for example, was quite badly affected. And one of the things that they did was adding more safety stock in their supply chains, shift from single to dual sourcing. That becomes a little bit more expensive. And I know that some of the automotive producers actually reversed some of their decisions back, which is they're hurting them now. So we have to see whether the pain that we are experiencing during this pandemic was actually strong enough that that's going to be something that people, particularly management in corporations, will actually remember and start taking risk and resilience in supply chains more seriously than we have until now.
And Marco, as we wrap up, for holiday shoppers out there, we heard stores stocked up early. Are you mm-hmm. recommending people start looking for things early, or maybe just be a little more flexible than we might have been in years past?
Yes. So my first recommendation would be for sure start early. But given the extent of the issues we are dealing with, I think a little bit of patience and perhaps managing our expectations, what products will be available and what products may not be, that can go a long way as well.
Marco, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Marco Bastl is Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Supply Chain Management at Marquette University. He joined us for a look at holiday shopping and how it could be affected by problems in the global retail supply chain. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about home renovation and hidden treasure.
You never know what you might find once you start renovating an old home, but that can be half the fun. Author Ron Davis thinks building and renovating are acts of faith, and he shares this story of odd coincidence and wishful thinking.
Anyone who's done serious renovation of an older home, ripping down lath and plaster, wrestling with stubborn 2x4s, and prying up floorboards, has probably harbored the fantasy of finding some kind of long hidden treasure. Civil War medals, a moth-eaten bag of precious coins, possibly a secret diary full of scandalous confessions. Unfortunately, what is often discovered are crumbling foundations, rotted timbers, and plumbing issues, if not a desiccated mouse or two. But sometimes a do-it-yourselfer finds a shoe. Through an amazing coincidence, two of my friends living 200 miles apart in Wisconsin told me shoe discovery stories. One was Celia, who found a dainty little girl's shoe in the recess above a window she and her husband Paul were replacing in their 1890s farmhouse in Amherst. The shoe was worn through, the leather cracked, but the cunning button hooks that ran up the side and its pointed toe still conveyed the elegance of old-world craftsmanship. Celia was fascinated with the shoe, both for the mystery of how it came to be there and the history of its owner. A high school art teacher, she added the shoe to her collection of objects to be sketched by her students, and then, 20 years later, passed the shoe on to the new owners of her home when she and her family moved. Another friend, Joe, has a reputation in his small town of Marshall for treasuring all things old. In fact, he and his wife Carrie have devoted a good share of their life to renovating a small hotel built there in 1873 as their family's home. A neighbor down the street who was rehabbing his own 100-year-old home told Joe, "You're gonna like this," and pointed to a toolbox holding a well-worn girl's boot he had found between two wall studs. Since retirement from a clinical psychology practice, Joe has devoted himself to charitable pursuits, repairing and repurposing antique furniture for auctions and fundraisers. He saw a different possibility for the shoe, offering a $250 scholarship competition to Marshall High English students who wanted to try writing an essay, poem, or story about the shoe, now property of the Marshall Historical Society. Though 30 years separated my hearing the two shoe stories, it felt like too much of a coincidence, and a little light research revealed it wasn't. Placing a shoe in a wall, a floor, behind a chimney, or above a door during construction is a tradition that dates back to the 12th century. Largely a European practice, particularly in the UK, shoes were even placed beneath the choir stalls in England's Winchester Cathedral, circa 1304. Building historians guess the concealed shoes originally served as magical charms to ward off witches, demons, and ghosts. Though a shoe placed under a bedroom floor may have been associated with fertility, think old woman who lived in a shoe, which may also explain why shoes are traditionally tied to the bumpers of newlyweds' cars. In America, hiding a child's shoe in the wall was a strong tradition, mainly in the Northeast. But apparently the custom was carried all the way to the Midwest before evidently dying out in the mid-20th century. Superstition or quaint custom, I see concealing a shoe in a wall as a poignant symbol of faith, of the confidence, and of the risks that lie behind anyone's notion to build or renovate a home. A concealed child's shoe, scuffed, cracked, and worn, is like the penny tossed into a fountain, a talisman of hope.
Ron Davis is a retired English teacher and the author of Shiny Side Up, Musings on the Improbable Inclination to Travel on Two Wheels. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, we'll find out what's driving up gas prices and the White House's latest moves to try and bring them down. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, hear about unique Thanksgiving food traditions from around the U.S. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, according to AAA, more than 48 million Americans are expected to travel by car over the Thanksgiving holiday, nearly a million of those from Wisconsin. It's up from last year, still down from pre-pandemic levels by about 8%. And it's going to cost more than last year. The average price of a gallon of gas in Wisconsin is $3.15. A year ago, $2. Price of gas has been higher in the past, in 2008 and 2014, for example. President Biden announced this week that he's releasing 50 million barrels of oil from the emergency stockpile to bring prices down. He said other countries will be reaching into their reserves as well.
And while our combined actions will not solve the problem of high gas prices overnight, it will make a difference. It will take time, but before long, you should see the price of gas drop where you fill up your tank.
Jim Ritterbusch is president of Ritterbusch & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm based in Galena, Illinois. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
We're seeing gas prices now highest level since 2014. What is driving that?
Well, it's always an array of factors that drive strong upward trends in gasoline. We've had very strong demand. We've had strong crude prices all year that contribute to about half of the increase in gasoline values. And refineries have been slow to recover this year following last year's pandemic. So it's a combo of factors, but, you know, it's a situation where demand has been quite strong this year, at least in comparison with last. And when you have demand this strong, it's partially a function of a strong economy. So we have a strong economy that boosts gasoline prices at the end of the day.
Was there an anticipation in the early days of the pandemic that demand was going to be down for a long time with the economic disruption that maybe didn't pan out as being as long a slump as people had thought?
Yeah, most analysts were behind the curve in anticipating just how fast this U.S. economy plus other economies around the globe would be able to rebound. So the recovery has been quite robust, and that's found a reflection to a large extent in a record high stock market, and it's also been a contributor to a strong inflationary pace overall.
So here we have this strategic reserve. Before we get into the impact tapping into that might have, can you tell us what is this and why do we have it?
It's a store of crude. It's stored mainly in these large salt caverns down in Louisiana and Texas regions. And it was constructed or devised years ago when we were very dependent upon OPEC production. So they came up with a plan to store crude in these caverns, and that supply, I believe at one time, was over 700 million barrels, and it's down around 600 million barrels presently.
So here we have 50 million barrels here in the U.S. We're going to tap into that. Other countries, we hear China, India, and others also tapping into their reserves. How much of an impact do you think that'll have on oil prices and then gas prices?
Well, if you looked at the futures market the past 2 days, you would say not much. Subsequent to the headlines that came out yesterday regarding a SPR release, futures popped almost $2 a barrel in crude oil. So this was a classic case of the old stock market adage of selling the rumor and buying the news. And as a result, we've boosted gasoline futures several cents, and that'll find some reflection at the pump here with a lag of 1 or 2 weeks.
Now, President Biden had also suggested that, hey, maybe there's some more profit-taking in the industry than there should be, saying, hey, look, oil prices went down a bit, but gas prices didn't follow. Is there anything to that?
There's always this lag. Crude prices come down, and I would say you're looking at two and a half weeks before you start to see impact at the retail gasoline level. So that's what we've seen. Plus, gasoline futures tend to come off in tandem with crude oil, and at one point they were down almost 20 cents since the beginning of this month. So you'll see some of that pass through or filter through into the retail gasoline channel. So we should see a little bit more relief, but not much.
So we see prices going up on oil, Jim. I guess my Econ 101 would say that means if I'm selling oil, I'm going to try to produce more of it to make more money, and that's going to drive prices down. Is it that simple?
It was that simple until the past year or so. And major oil companies increased what we call this shale production considerably in recent years. And then their stocks really didn't perform. And as a result, generally, they adopted a strategy of plowing cash back into stock buybacks, trying to boost stock market returns to their shareholders, and they paid very little attention to growing production. So, in other words, it's been a value over growth scenario that's transpired here this year, and as a result, production is just moving up very gradually, and hasn't kept pace with this strong path of demand that I alluded to previously.
So what are you watching for? I mean, it'll cost more for this Thanksgiving holiday travel season. What are you watching for, say, in the months to come?
A wild card that I see in the months to come is the COVID. We're seeing a dramatic increase in Europe, especially in Austria, in COVID-19, and as a result, we've seen some lockdowns and restrictions in Europe. If that spreads, that's going to be a major demand deterrent. So the good news is it would put downside pressure on gasoline prices, but at the same time, that's not a good reason to reduce gasoline prices.
And then what are you watching for with OPEC in particular, and whether they're going to ramp up production? I've heard even thoughts that they might bring it down to balance out these strategic stockpile releases. What are you watching for there?
We'll get a better view at the end of next week, a week from tomorrow. They have their monthly meeting. And there is a possibility that they could attempt to retaliate by reducing their planned or their scheduled production increases that amount to about 400,000 barrels a month. So it's a tough call. My feeling is that they're going to maintain the status quo. I don't think they want to get into a food fight with the White House over trying to keep prices up as opposed to the effort of the United States and some allies that are trying to press them down. So I don't see that scenario playing out myself. So I think that there's a strong chance that they'll simply stay with their plan, boost production another 400,000 a month to be announced next week. And from there, we'll see if that can begin to catch up with this strong pace of demand.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. Have a nice Thanksgiving.
You too. That's Jim Ritterbusch with Ritterbusch & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm in Galena, Illinois, talking about the recent rise in gas prices. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, there can be a lot of value in friendships with people from different generations. Find out why and hear stories of people who made friends across the ages. That and more tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then in school board debates across the country, some parents are pushing for more control over what schools teach and how they teach it. But how much say do they really have? We'll talk to an education historian about that and other times schools have faced a backlash throughout history. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we take a look at the latest COVID news and numbers ahead of the holiday weekend. First, in school board meetings across the country, some parents are pushing for more control over what schools teach and how they teach it. Many of those parents have focused in on how schools teach about race and a variety of concepts that have been labeled as critical race theory. But education experts say there are some big practical issues with letting parents decide what schools do and don't teach, and educational issues if kids aren't exposed to different ideas. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much say do you think parents should get when it comes to how teachers teach their children? How should teachers navigate a situation where some parents support teaching about a topic but others don't? Are you seeing these kinds of issues and debates coming up in your community, in your school district, whether you're seeing it as a student, a parent, a teacher or school board member, or an interested member of the public? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jack Schneider is an education historian and associate professor at the University of Massachusetts Lowell School of Education. He also co-hosts the education policy podcast, Have You Heard? Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
You've worked in the education field for some time now. What are you making of this, what appears to be anyway, a backlash we're seeing against some schools around the country right now?
Well, on the one hand, it's completely predictable that backlash is nothing new in American politics. It's not even new in the educational sphere, where we often see politics held at bay somewhat by the fact that, you know, 90% of the kids who are in schools in this country are in public schools. And so we all have...
I think we lost Jack. Do we still have you on the line, Jack? Looks like we've lost him. We're talking to Jack Schneider from the University of Massachusetts Lowell School of Education, looking at backlash to schools and debates in districts around the country. I think we have you back. Jack, pick up if you can where you left off. Nope. Not there. Well, I'll remind you, you can call in at 800-642-1234 if these are issues you're seeing in your own schools, in your own community. What do you think about the idea of parents getting a say in what is taught, how it's taught, how direct a say should that be, or is the ability to elect or unelect school board members enough? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I just heard a click there. Does that mean we have our guest? Nope. Okay. Well, let's take a break now. We'll get this all sorted out and hopefully come in. You can again join in at 800-642-1234. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We'll have another go at our conversation about parental rights and education and a look back at other times we've seen backlashes against schools through history. We've got Jack Schneider with us, education expert at the University of Massachusetts, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jack, I you're back with us. I apologize. That was all on our end. Let's pick up again with your thoughts on this current backlash we're seeing here.
Sure. Yeah, I was just saying that, you know, it was easy to anticipate that there would be some sort of backlash, even if we couldn't imagine exactly what the nature of it would be. And even if it wasn't possible to assume that it would happen in the schools, right, that the schools, because people of all political persuasions have their kids in public schools, have often been immune to some of the broader culture wars that we've seen repeat over and over in American history. But that hasn't always been the case. We definitely have seen culture wars spill into the schools and play out in ways that caused a lot of turmoil. The one that listeners may be most familiar with is the conflict over the teaching of evolution in the early 20th century, although listeners are probably equally familiar with the fight over desegregation in the mid-20th century. So this is nothing new in terms of culture war pouring into the schools, this claim about having a right to determine the way that education is being delivered to particular children is also not new. And it's also not new that, you know, this kind of what Richard Hofstadter called the paranoid style in American politics, this kind of paranoid approach that is really designed to gin up resentment among conservatives and Republicans, is also something that we've seen before, where the resentment against an inflated enemy, you know, an imaginary boogeyman who may be a communist or a Marxist or, in this case, you know, a Black Lives Matter protester, right? Because so much of this is about race. If you can exercise the imagination of conservatives and convince them that there is some vast conspiracy that they need to fight against, it can be really helpful for turning people out for elections.
Let's flip things around. Is there a better constructive way to say, hey, we have this topic of race in the United States? It's a messy topic. There's a lot of bad stuff to talk about. How can we bring the community together and talk about this, engage with it in a constructive way to figure out how we talk about this in our schools?
I think it's really important first to remind people that our schools are public schools. They aren't free schools. There's a difference between free and public, right? You can have a free private school that caters to every individual parent's wishes. Public schools are responsive to the public. We fund them with our tax dollars, and there's a reason that we do that, because they are designed to serve the public good. The original motivating impetus behind a nationwide system of public schools, free and open to all, regardless of paperwork, was democratic equality, preparing young people to participate in a democratic society. And I think if we can all accept that, then maybe there's some room to accept the fact that schools should, right, they have a responsibility to expose young people to ideas that we ourselves may not be entirely comfortable with, we may actually oppose, and that that's actually a part of preparing them to participate as equal members in a democratic society where they're going to encounter those ideas, like them or not.
on a practical level, I remember back in my school days, there were concerns from some religious communities about topics they didn't like being on the curriculum. There was also, just after I graduated, a minor blow up in my school district where an atheist parent had challenged the inclusion of talking about religion in American history. In a situation like that, with the idea of parental control, how do you decide which parents in a case like that to listen to?
Well, if parents had total control over the curriculum, we would see these kinds of conflicts over and over, right? Not just over religion, over any issue that had become politicized. And this is why parents do have the right to opt out of the public education system. So this is well established, right? You can go back to the 1925 Supreme Court case, Pierce versus Society of Sisters. That if parents have deeply held religious beliefs, and it could be motivated by something other than religion, but that case was about religion, then they can opt their kids out of the public system. But the schools that are funded by taxpayers for the purpose of strengthening a democratic society cannot cater to the individual, potentially idiosyncratic views and worldviews of populations that, you know, in many cases, don't hold every member of our society in equal esteem and respect, right? That we want our schools to be places where everybody has what scholar Siegel Ben Porath refers to as dignitary safety, right? Everybody's dignity needs to be assured in the schools. And that's something that I think we've done a pretty poor job of making clear, that much of what is being treated as the politics of race is actually about assuring the dignity of young people who have been racially minoritized and racially marginalized over the years. But while we're assuring their dignitary safety, nobody's intellectual safety should be secured. That's a big part of what schools do, is expose people to new ideas and new beliefs, and they don't have to adopt them. And in fact, they go home to families that in many cases actively work against the things that kids have learned in schools, and that's okay too, right? The point of all of this shouldn't be to ensure that everybody in America, every young person in the schools, ends up agreeing with one side or the other. You know, there's historian John Zimmerman's famous quip about how, you know, it can't be that as long as there's open inquiry and dialogue and debate that you're going to end up agreeing with me, right? We can't hold that belief. We have to be open to the possibility that there will be disagreement and that people won't side with us when they're exposed to all the facts. And we have to remember that parents and families have tremendous influence over young people. And it's very rare that, you know, schools end up completely turning a young person against the beliefs and values that they're exposed to at home.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Chad is with us in Minnesota. Chad, hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up, Chad?
Just everything as far as critical race theory, and I'm just, this is my exposure, and I'm a senior in Weber State in Utah. But everything that I've been exposed with critical race theory and everything I've heard, not an expert, people are misinformed as far as what critical race theory is. Everybody's just basing it off of, from what I've read, it's being pushed, and this is just coming at the college level and being pushed at the lower level. There are ideas that need to be exposed to, but unfortunately, a lot of people are just viewing it through race, it seems like, and just picking pieces of critical theory and pushing it off as another. And I do believe that, like, I'm spacing as Amy was talking, everybody has to be having conflict of ideology, and that society is based on that. But some people are just not willing to hear another side, and that's also where another disconnect is.
Chad, thanks.
Both parents and all them.
Thanks for the call, Chad. First of all, the definition of critical race theory, Jack, very much varies depending on who's, I guess, doing the talking and what agenda they're advancing when it comes to schools.
Yeah, absolutely. An important point there, that critical race theory comes out of legal scholarship in the 1970s and 80s. You know, go read Kimberly Crenshaw if you want to read some of that stuff. But right now, really, it's a kind of generic catch-all. And I think it's really because those are three things that Americans generally don't like, right? Critical, that sounds bad. Race, Americans generally don't like talking about race. And theories for eggheads like me, right? Americans are disinterested in that. And so you've got a linguistically convenient phrase that you can apply to any discussion of race that is making white people uncomfortable, which happens to be a lot of the conversations about race, you know, factually grounded conversations about race and racial inequality. And I think we need to, on the left, those of us who have been making the case that, you know, this isn't critical race theory being taught in the schools, we need to stop being so naive, right? That's not really what the right is arguing. And folks on the right need also to be a little bit less naive and recognize the fact that, you know, it is politically convenient to stoke outrage on both sides. But in this case, it's the outrage of white conservatives that's being stoked, and that they ought to be attuned to the fact that, again, it's politically convenient for the Republican Party at this moment.
Thanks for the call, Chad, at 800-642-1234. Let's go now to John in Madison. John, hi.
Hey, guys. Say, I all due respect, I think your guest is really verging on some intellectual dishonesty here. There is a difference between teaching a theory, or such as Marxist economics as opposed to Keynesian economics, critical legal studies as opposed to law and economic studies. There's a difference between teaching a theory and viewing something and teaching a view through that theory. It's one thing to teach critical race theory as this is a theory of how one understands the structural problems and legal Constitution and property rights and all of that stuff. And that is one way to look at this problem. There's other ways. There's other theories about it. It's one thing to do that, but it's another thing to teach history through that lens, to teach racism, race issues through that lens and say, well, that lens is the reality. So there is a distinction. Happy to teach all sorts of theories. I've got two high schoolers. I'd love them to be exposed to all the stuff I was exposed to.
John, thanks a lot for the call. Jack, what do you think of his point that it's one thing to say we are teaching you about these tools that critical race theory might bring to the table? It's another if we say we're going to teach race informed by critical race theory as the way to understand it.
I think the most important thing to remember here is there are 13,000 school districts and 100,000 schools in the United States. And so it is impossible to say anything about what's happening everywhere or even in most places, that it really varies from place to place. Now, are there some places that are teaching a particular understanding of American history, right? The caller's question was primarily about history, so let's stick with that. Are there places that are saying, we're going to apply this particular lens to history in our school or our district? Sure. And there are equally places that don't understand that they're applying a particular lens or a particular theory or a particular worldview or a particular ideology to the teaching of history, who are doing the same. And I think that any scholar of the teaching of history or social studies, and there are many of them out there, would tell you that it's essential to be putting in conversation these various interpretations of history, right? There is no neutral interpretation of history. There's no entirely factual presentation of history. History is about the interpretation of the past. And we interpret it through values, beliefs, ideas, worldviews. And the caller's not wrong, right? That absolutely does happen, and that it's important to expose young people to different ways of understanding the past. So if somebody's out there teaching, you know, Howard Zinn and nothing but Howard Zinn in the history classroom, there's an opportunity being missed there. And young people are actually being poorly prepared because they aren't going to come out of that classroom able to understand, okay, well, here's one interpretation, here's another interpretation of history. Let me try to put them in conversation with one another, and let me try to figure out what I think about all of this, right? So there's great opportunity for critical thinking when we put different kinds of interpretations of the past in conversation with one another. And that's actually what I hear most history educators talking about what they do in their classrooms.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Jack Schneider, education historian at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Let's go back to your calls now. Jerry is with us in Madison. Jerry, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to point out that the African-American Jewish Friendship Group has sponsored a bill along with State Representative Lakeisha Myers of Milwaukee to, it's called the African-American History Education Act. And the purpose of it is to educate all students in the state of Wisconsin as to the truth of American history and infuse African-American history into it so that the good and the bad of our country's history is taught to all school, all students. And the students, all students will benefit from learning the truth rather than trying to ban certain types of events, for instance, the Tulsa Massacre, which is 100 years ago, should have been taught all along to students so they would be aware of the truth of that.
Jerry, thanks for the call. I want to bring our guest into that. Jack, what do you think of that idea of a, it would be a statewide law, a mandate requiring the teaching of African-American history?
You know, the teaching of African-American history is something that is critical in our history classrooms, and it's being done all across the United States, and that it's not actually a new move. In the early 20th century, there were school districts, Chicago being one example, that began integrating Black history into the city curriculum. Philadelphia made bold moves in the late 20th century in this regard. The fact that we need to continue to make this case, I think that's what tells us something about the level of comfort among the white majority in this country around the teaching of the past in a way that directly addresses race. And I think, you know, there isn't an easy way out of this because it's an uncomfortable history that makes a lot of people feel like they are being threatened in some way by addressing this past directly. We have to do it, but I think there's a way that we can do it without necessarily alienating people who are uncomfortable around this. So I don't think that this is a simple case of one side being wrong and wants to ban books, the other side is on the side of justice. I think that to some extent that's the story here, but I think it's also the case that you know, as that earlier caller mentioned, these different viewpoints need to be put in conversation with one another. And I have great faith in the American people, in as much as I believe that if they have time to talk with each other, and that certainly is something that schools give us, right? 180 days for young people to sit around talking with each other. And if they are guided by an expert, we have that in this country. We've got 3 million trained teachers who are in charge in our classrooms. And if we can trust our democratically elected school boards to oversee this process, and that's another critical piece here, right? When people are making the parents' rights argument, they're forgetting that they do have a say over what's happening in the schools. We all do. Right? Our school boards, which oversee our public schools, are democratically elected. It's their job to respond to the public desire and the public demand. So I believe in deliberation. I believe in contestation, as long as, again, we're assuring everybody's dignitary safety. I believe in the marketplace of ideas. And I particularly believe in young people. And so I've got faith that if we are open to the possibility of disagreement in our schools, and if we trust professional educators, and if we participate in the democratic process, that we're going to get there.
Jack, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Jack Schneider, education historian and associate professor at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, also co-host of the Education Policy Podcast, Have You Heard? He was with us today for a look back at the history of backlashes against schools and the latest over parental rights in education. Coming up after the news, COVID cases are going up again, including among children. A doctor tells us what's behind the current surge and what the future could hold. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.